The Park City School District had a lot going on at their meeting last night. And in studio to give us the details, our school board member, Andrew Kaplan, and District Communications Director, Molly Miller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So a lot happened last night. Where do you want to start? I mean, what stood out for you from last night?
Well, I think it's a kind of a last night's meeting was a continuation of where we left off at the previous meeting and kind of the tone that we've been trying to set, which is, you know, the process of looking at the school bond and doing a community survey has really helped us understand what aspects of the bond the community supports and what aspects they still have concerns about. And what we've heard loud and clear is that the community wants to be involved. They want to vet the different options for, you know, for everything from grade realignment to what the buildings are going to look like, et cetera. And what seems to be consensus from our surveys and from anecdotally talking to our constituents is that everyone acknowledges that we have a capacity issue and we have needs for new facilities. We have ones that are outdated. We have, you know, this year we're going to have trailers. You probably have seen them on 248. You know, we have trailers at Treasure. We're going to have trailers at, you know, obviously still at Trailside. We're going to have trailers at a number of different schools, McPullen, I believe. Parley's and Jeremy, I think, are the two that escape the portable learning chalets. But we, you know, we are certainly, at, you know, we're filled. And, you know, the issue is now, okay, how do we move forward? And the community, I think, is still somewhat skeptical to support a bond after the last, you know, the failed bond. And the onus is on us as a district to communicate better and to continue to do our community outreach to, you know, to everyone and educate them on what our needs are, what the current situation is, and what our options are for moving forward. I think all five of us feel strongly that we would have liked to have started building new facilities last year, probably in 2015 when the last bond failed. But we also acknowledge that this is such a huge capital expense and it's such a huge amount of tax dollars that we need to really make sure that the community feels comfortable and has full buy-in before we move forward.
So the survey responses indicate there are perceptions out there that the bond about the bond, which are not correct. And Molly, you are putting out a FAQ, a frequently asked questions about that you hope to have done in the next couple of weeks, from what I understand.
Definitely. And so Anne, our newest board member, had a great list of four buckets that she placed all of these things in, where it seemed like people weren't completely clear on the progress we had made so far and what our plans were for the future. And she said that they fell under space, growth and buildings, leadership and listening, academics and education, and safety and drugs. And I had a few more categories, but she really encapsulated those comments in those four buckets. And I'll be working closely with Anne to really create digestible answers to those questions that people can process. We're also going to post all those comments online along with that updated information to really give people access to look at what's been done and what the next steps are. And really the board did express a lot of gratitude and appreciation for that feedback. It's just so valuable, and it gives us a place to really get started in clarifying the information and start our real deep listening.
Do we know what created those misconceptions about?
Gosh, you know, I think misconceptions are really common. Not people don't have a ton of time to really keep close tabs on everything that's going on. I know we all have at least one job, and most of us have things that we're running to here and there, and not a whole lot of time to keep tabs on what the district is doing. And that's part of my job, and a great challenge that I have is to really concisely communicate those things accurately to help inform people.
So the board approved a long list of new positions at the meeting last night. What can you tell us about the new positions and if they've already been filled, and what systems the district will use to ensure that the new hires understand their jobs, expectations, and getting them up and going before school starts in August?
Yeah, so those positions are all filled. The ones that we approve, those are the actual people who will be in those positions. We do have a new onboarding program this year because, you know, as the district grows and we have quite a few hires this year, we acknowledge that we haven't done the best job of onboarding our new employees. And I think, you know, the district and our community is kind of going through some growing and we, you know, now we acknowledge at the district level that we need to make sure that our onboarding process is more robust. And, you know, we have a new principal starting at Trailside that we're very excited about. We have a new associate superintendent of wellness starting this year. We had, you know, I think the list was probably about 15 to 20 long, you know, and maybe even more in terms of both licensed and classified positions. And so it's a lot of new people joining the district, and we're excited about that. It kind of goes along with, you know, as I've discussed before, the growth that we have in our student body. And some of those positions that we approved last night are replacements of existing headcount, and then some of them were new.
So who is the new principal for Trailside, and where do they come from?
The new principal is Carolyn Sinan. She was the assistant principal at Edison down in Salt Lake, and she originally is from Chicago. We're very excited to have her. She, you know, Edison is an interesting school. It was the biggest turnaround school in the state, and she was integral in that process. So we're bringing a different skill set and a kind of a different perspective up to Park City. That school is, I think, 97% free and reduced lunch, whereas, you know, our schools are about a quarter free and reduced lunch. So definitely a different demographic there. But, you know, she has an excellent background and level of experience, and we're excited to have her.
Great. During the discussion about the amount of time allotted for people to come and make public comment, currently it's 3 minutes per individual and 5 minutes per group. Andrew, you commented in the meeting last night that you've spent hours of wasted time during the meeting, and Julie commented that the job of the board is to do business and that public comment is necessary, but so is doing the business of the school district. What are your feelings about the waste of your time?
Well, let me clarify that. I think that our meetings are not as efficient as they could be. And the point I was trying to make is that if we're going to prioritize things, last night's meeting, we spent between open and closed session over 4 hours. That's been, you know, in the 7 months that I've been on the school board, that's probably been the average. I think, you know, our meetings have lasted between open and closed about 4 to 5 hours, and we have, you know, we have a lot going on, but we've also added a lot of extra meetings in those 7 months. And so, you know, I'd say every 1 to 2 weeks we have one of those meetings, which is a significant commitment of time. And I think that, when we're making on average 1 to 2 decisions over that period of time, I think it's frustrating for everyone. It's frustrating for the board as well as the public. And, what we've heard from public is that they want to be heard, you know, during our public meetings and during our comment. And, you know, I personally think that there isn't a whole lot that's more important than representing our constituents and hearing from them in whatever forum that they feel comfortable, whether that's via email, a phone call to us, or, you know, for them to be able to speak during our public comment. And so, you know, my point was we're spending, and maybe perhaps, you know, waste of time was a bad choice of words, but the point I'm making is that if we're spending 4 hours having a meeting, I'm more than happy to sit an extra 15 minutes and make time for people to voice their opinions. And, you know, again, in the last 7 months, we haven't had any public comment that's gone over 30 minutes. And so to artificially restrict the time that any one individual has to speak, I think is, needs to be changed. And I think that that's the direction that the board is going, is that we're going to review that policy and we're going to have a decision item at the August 18th meeting, I believe, and try to fix that.
Yeah, because at planning and city council, well, planning meetings, oh my gosh, if it's a treasure night, we're going to be there a long time.
Yeah, and I think, I think it's up to the discretion of the board chair as well, that if, you know, we have a huge stack of papers of public comment and or we have a highly controversial issue, that we organize, you know, the comments and we try to manage the time. But, you know, 95% of the time, we have plenty of time and we only have a few speakers. And so I don't think that, it's part of the overall
goal that we have of trying to change the perception of the school district. And we want people to understand that we're listening and we care. And we, you know, I represent the families that, you know, that live in my district and around Trailside, and, you know, and that's my job, right? That's what I was elected to do. So for me not to listen or to cut people off seems, you know, somewhat contradictory.
Right. Well, is there anything that you would like to add before I let you go, Molly?
Yes, please. Just keep in touch. Check in on the district website and on the Facebook page. We have a district Facebook page. I'll be posting information about community meetings with the board members as we dig deeper into this community visioning and planning for the future. Our strategic planning starts in August. We will be reaching out to many, many, many community members to participate in that. It's a 6 to 8 month process. And also sign up for those text alerts. I'll be sending those out regularly. 435-602-4444. And you can also sign up through our website.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. KPCW News time is 8:28. You're listening to the local News Hour. I'm Melissa Allison, filling in for Leslie Thatcher, who will be back next week. In studio right now, we have Park City Manager Diane Foster and Transportation Planning Manager Alfred Knotts to talk about tomorrow night's meeting. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There's a lot on the agenda.
Again.
And so I think we should just kick it off, Alfred, with you. SR 248, what's happening there?
We are requesting authorization to execute a contract with Lochner Engineering. This is to begin the preliminary engineering in the environmental work on the 248 corridor project. There's been previous studies done back in 2009, but we're looking to advance that project. They weren't done to a level of design or environmental to get the project approved. So we're advancing the project with local funds. If you look in the packet, too, there's a draft STIP sheet, which is the State Transportation Improvement Program, where UDOT has programmed $10 million for the project. So the project itself is to look at the 248 corridor in its entirety. The previous studies also didn't do that. So the big picture is to look at advancing our transit system and to give transit priority through the corridor. So we've looked at doing the same thing on 224. We've implemented the express bus service on there, but again, it doesn't have the priority and the dedicated right-of-way through the corridor. So we're looking to do that on 248. And again, the big picture is to have this project start construction in 2019 and include bike lanes, aesthetic improvements to the corridor, school access improvements, and then as the community's recently been made aware of, we're making progress towards constructing our arts and culture district in Bonanza Park, which also would include a heavy transit element too. So tying that all together through the corridor from Bonanza all the way out to the US 40 corridor, and then also bringing that asset we have out there online, which is the Richardson Flat parking lot. So it's important for the community to kind of see how all these work, and it's important for us as the city and myself to explain how all this works too. So that's the big picture of the project.
I'm excited that this is really the kickoff of the construction, right? So for years, and it's appropriate that transportation capital projects like this go through a lot of planning because it needs careful work. But this is really, you know, getting it in the ground. The other piece that I'm really proud of Alfred on this one is that he brought with him something that was new to Utah. So Alfred previously was in the Tahoe area, and that was working with the state and front-loading the project from a financial perspective to get it earlier, going earlier than the state would have had us do. Do you want to talk to that, Alfred?
Yeah. Actually, UDOT doesn't have any plans to do this project until about 2025. I don't think our community is willing to wait that long. Neither am I. So as Diane mentioned, we put some local funding together to advance the project, and they've made a commitment to push that project up on the state priority list also. So it's very important that we have that relationship because these are UDOT facilities, but they're letting us take control and take the lead on the project so we can do the project in a local context. Typically, the state DOT would come in and widen the road and build more lanes. I think we've made a commitment at a policy level, and the council has also, that that's not what we want for our community. So we're focusing on mass transportation, sustainable transportation, and alternative modes to achieve our transportation goals, and not designing or constructing specifically for the automobile. So
can you tell me, who was it you said approved the $10 million for the project?
That's on the State Transportation Commission board. So it's on the draft list right now.
UDOT, it didn't approve anything, like you said, until 2025.
Correct. So this is their near-term construction funding for the project. So We don't know exactly what that project is. I mean, we've identified what the objectives are, transit's objective. But as Diane said, it's important that we go back out to the community and we get that input, not only just within Park City, but also adjacent communities, since those are our travelers on that corridor. They're going to have a lot of input on this project also.
So some of the ideas that have already transpired to help in this project are the Eat Right program, which kicks off today. There's the bike rally, right?
Correct.
At noon. And what other things do you have in store to move this project along to create this goal of lowering the amount of single occupancy vehicles and lowering the miles that are traveled? Because that's a, like you said, especially when the art center comes along, there's going to be a lot of traffic. So what other things do you have?
You're correct. That if you look at the corridors and the growth on the corridors for traffic, 224 actually only grows about 0.5% a year. 248 is growing at almost 3% a year. So, and we know where that growth is going to come from, and most of that is going to come on from the Heber Valley and the Camas Valley, which is going to be traffic coming on US 40 and 248. So we are looking to provide that transit priority. We know that, you know, we have a great system, but if it doesn't compete or exceed travel times of the automobile, you know, we're not going to get everybody to shift, mode shift from single occupancy vehicle. And we recognize not everybody's going to do that. It doesn't meet everybody's needs on a daily basis. But the idea is to provide that transit priority, use lots like the Richardson Flat lot to intercept people before they do come into our corridors, and then to also achieve our air quality goals also by using mass transportation as well. So, and then the e-bike program, again, it's not and by any means a silver bullet in itself, but it's all part of the overall network and the system to give people options and alternatives. When they do come into town on transit, that now they can use the e-bike program to make short trips, run errands and things like that when they don't have their automobile within town also. So
Diane, staff is recommending that a council approve $1.3 million for Lochner to help with this project. Why them?
Alfred was part of the selection committee, and I believe they have experience in this project. And Alfred, do you want to talk to the bidding process?
Yeah, we went through a very rigorous process. We used the state DOT process. So we went through UDOT's procurement process, and we did a request for qualifications and proposals. So we did solicit, and we did receive proposals from a few different firms, Lochner being one. We went through a selection committee process, even interview process with the consultant firms too. And it was unanimously decided that Lochner was the most qualified for this firm, and they understood the project, they understood the local goals better than the other firms. And then costs also, you know, it's not a determining factor, but obviously as a keeper of the public trust, we have to consider costs within the contract too, and they had a very good and competitive price also.
So start to finish, how long are we looking at?
This contract, this portion of it, is looking at 15 months. This is a federally funded project through that $10 million that I mentioned from UDOT. So that is federal funds. So we have to go through what is known as NEPA. It's the National Environmental Policy Act, and prepare an environmental assessment. And that looks at everything. And that's what we'll do this summer is collect information on cultural resources, biological resources, botanical resources, visual resources, our air quality inventories. And then also get the technical information collected as well related to geotechnical information, hydrology, and design work so that they can design through the winter period. So it's critical that we get this project off the ground within the next couple of weeks so we can get out into the field and get these surveys done before the field season closes on us.
Okay. Further on in the agenda, there's the consideration to approve a purchase agreement between Bonanza Park and Utah Limited Liability Company. What's that about?
Number five. That's actually the Arts and Culture District. I'm just reading through the Bonanza Park East parcel. Yeah, this is one of four actions that staff is recommending that City Council take, and we're super excited about the idea of the Arts and Culture District. And so that particular one is what's called a real estate purchase contract, where we agree to enter into a contract with the intent to purchase. There's actually an incredibly long due diligence period. I believe it's at least 6 months long, where we'll be looking at a lot of different things from environmental to other conditions on the ground. I believe there's like a $100,000 escrow payment in that. And so there's a huge public process that happens with that. The other pieces are letters of intent with the Kimball Arts Center and the Sundance Institute, agreeing to move forward in a process where we will look at master planning that area as a team. And included in that is actually in the letter of intent with Sundance is an agreement that the city is willing to look at renegotiating the Sundance contract and making that longer. And we've heard that from, for example, the lodging community. That's one of the things they'd like us to do as well. And then the other piece in there is asking the city council to approve a 1%. The city does not currently levy a transient room tax. And so it's asking the city council if they're willing to levy a 1% transient room tax, which is the maximum that the city is allowed to levy.
Okay. Also on the agenda is the maintenance and repair of the parking infrastructure located at Public Works on Iron Horse and China Bridge Parking. Is that part of the program that we're trying to implement this year? Are those the changes and repairs to the facade of the building to help people identify?
That one is specifically maintenance that we do periodically. We do maintenance on our structures every year. And as you heard Kenzie Colson, our parking manager, talk about is if we don't, it's like roads. If you don't keep up with them, they become really expensive to maintain. So this is a regular maintenance process that we do. And the good news is I think Kenzie's going to be on with you tomorrow morning to talk about that, as well as, importantly, she'll have Julie Dixon with her to talk about the Main Street parking fees. And I'm very excited about what came out in that. And if people want a preview, you can read it. I know they've been meeting with folks on Main Street this week and a lot of the businesses. You can go ahead and read that in the city council report, which is at parkcity.org. And what I really like about it personally, just an opinion, is that it's very easy to understand. So as someone who works in the Main Street Corps and as someone who will be using mass transit and taking my car a lot less to work than I usually do, although just like every other employee, it's not the expectation that you'll take mass transit every day, although we like that. It's that you won't necessarily bring your car to work every single day. And on those days where you need to run an errand, okay, maybe you'll bring your car that day. And it's really easy to understand in a process.
Okay, because on the agenda is the parking meter rates, violation towing, and impound fees resolution. Is that part of...
That's how city council will adopt. They have to... it's one thing in the work session, Kenzie and Julie Dixon will come and talk about the why behind the parking fees and what we think it will do and how this all works into our transportation demand management program. And then we're asking council to formally adopt it by resolution.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add before I let you go?
I will say Luke Carton also has a very interesting and exciting item on the carbon sink. We're moving forward on our carbon goals. And lastly, we invite anyone to come to City Council tomorrow night who's interested in the Arts and Culture District. We have heard some folks have some concerns about it. You saw an editorial in the Park Record last night that is questioning whether it's necessary. I think most people I've talked to are pretty excited about it. And so this is a time to come talk to City Council tomorrow night, which is July 20th. I expect it'll show up on the agenda sometime between kind of maybe 6:15 and 6:30 at latest. So we'll look forward to that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. That is City Manager Diane Foster and Alfred Knotts. We will be back in a moment. The Sundance Institute has partnered with Park City for a screening of Chasing Coral, a documentary that talks about the ever-changing world beneath the sea and the environmental impacts on it. In studio to talk about the film, our Sundance Institute Representative Assistant Director, Utah Government and Communications Relations, was that it? Sorry, they just threw it on me, folks. Kara Cody and Environmental Sustainability Manager Luke Carton. Good morning. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So I watched the film clip for this movie. It's incredible. It's visually stunning, The color and everything. What can you tell me about it?
You know, it's a documentary about coral bleaching. It is directed by Jeff Orlowski, who also did Chasing Ice, which was, huge hit several years ago at the festival about melting glaciers and polar ice caps. It is visually stunning. The technology that went into making the film, as well as the heart that went into making it as well. It was won the Audience Award for U.S. Documentary at the festival this year. So that kind of gives you a preview of, what audiences thought of it.
Right. And so why are we showing it here, Luke?
Yeah, a couple different reasons. First of all, we actually got to see it during the Sundance Film Festival at the Cine Transformer and a couple other pieces. And we had it was really impactful in the community. And everyone's like, well, it's Coral. You know, what's that to do with our mountain life? But it actually ties in really well to what we're trying to do in this community and shows that what we can do here can help have a broader impact. Park City actually does get a shout out at the end as well, which is kind of neat to see in the film. And it's impactful. It kind of shows how everything's tied together, no matter what the boundary or ecosystem you live in is.
And so who do you think will be interested in this event? Friday night, right?
Yeah. Correct. Friday evening. I mean, I think everybody should be interested.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film. I mean, just that alone, the artwork, the art that goes in behind it is... It's really stunning film to watch. And yeah, there is a message in there that kind of gets you bummed out. But there's also the message of hope as well, and showing how all these scientists around the world are getting together to help figure this out and figure out how to preserve the coral we've got and also move forward. And it's, like I said, it kind of ties it into the larger global picture. And it's really well done. It's not just a typical beat you over the head with science and graphs. It actually takes you to these locations. They do some long-term studies, things that have never been tried before, and it's a great way to take in all the information.
So where is this event happening?
At City Park, kind of in the lower park area, in the band shell that's next to Miners Hospital. We'll have activities starting at 7:30. We have a whole host of organizations located here in Park City and Summit County that'll be on site to tell you more about the great work they're doing to help our planet. And then Zach Rago, who is one of the scientists and self-proclaimed coral nerd, it's featured in the film, will actually be on site as well. And then Park City Municipal is doing a discussion starting at about 8:45. And the film will start at dusk a bit after 9.
So what's that conversation going to consist of, Luke?
It's just to help tie it back together. You know, we'll take some of the latest climate science, get people up to speed. But the other thing that folks need to realize in this community is it's something to take pride in. I mean, what we're doing here is a lot of first-in-the-nation type things. A great example is the e-bike share that launches today at noon. No one else in the country is doing that right now. Our electric express bus routes, our 100% committed campaigns. We have a lot of things going on here, and it's just kind of brief the community on all of the things we have going on, and it helps tie in that to the larger issue of climate change, and also shows, you know, what's going on in other realms that we usually don't think of.
So, you know, you mentioned we're in the mountains. We're not out at sea or on along the coasts or islands. What can people do here?
I think it's you know, it sounds crazy, but keep doing what we're doing. We're doing a great job. Is, you know, we're trying to not only just say, hey, you know, only do this one little piece. We're trying to change the systems. We're trying to change how folks get around, how our energy is delivered to us. And for people, it's understanding what's going on around them and understanding how they can change what they do and to make truthfully their life better. We were having a conversation with Ethel outside here about the electric bus and you know how it's really truly easy now to get from Kimball Junction to Old Town just as quick as a car. It's beautiful now with the bike shares tied in as well. It's, you know, these things are happening all around us, so we just want to make sure that more people understand what we're doing and just understand the momentum's heading in the right direction and just stay involved.
Well, you know, Park City, Yellowstone, they eradicated wolves from the area, and it changed the ecosystem out there, and they found out that it was detrimental, that they were part of keeping that in balance. How do we keep the pendulum from swinging one way to the direct other and just creating more problems, if that makes sense?
No, I think you lost me a little bit on that, but, you know, there is the wolf thing's actually really interesting. It's like a 7-minute Vimeo or something like that. It's a really cool piece that talks about how wolves change the river there. And here it's the same concept of, you know, as we try to make things work more together rather than against each other. You can view it as, you know, these aren't opposing forces. We're not taking cold water and hot water and mixing them together to make warm water so no one kind of wins. You can view them more of like ingredients in making bread. We're trying to make the best bread we have. So, you know, certain pieces we mix together, we want to do it in the right way to make sure everything kind of acts in a symbiotic relationship.
So is this for all ages? Is everyone welcome?
Everyone is welcome. It is free and open to the public. The film was included in our student screening series during the 2017 festival. I would say it's probably appropriate for ages, you know, approximately 13 and older. But, you know, we'll leave that to, you know, parents to decide. But it is, you know, just, you know, a beautiful film with a great, great message. And we hope that the community will come out.
So is there anything you'd like to add before I let you go?
No, that I mean, Sundance is just excited, you know, to work with, you know, the city on this screening and just, you know, shows the power of public-private partnerships and collaborations.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning and talking about this film. I'm going to go.
Excellent.
I want to see it.
Excellent.
Yeah. Well, just from that little clip, it is so beautiful. But it does break your heart to see all the bleaching going along. And I personally would like to know what I can do in this inland area to bring it back, maybe. Okay. All right. Well, that was sustainability manager, environmental sustainability manager Luke Carton, and Utah community and government relations rep Kara Cody. Thank you so much. We will be back in a moment. Well, Alpine Distilling has recently added a collection of nods from the 2017 SIP Awards. Their Traveler's Rest 88-proof single malt whiskey and Persistent Vodka earned gold and silver medals, respectively. In studio to tell us about it is owner and managing director Rob Sargent. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us. So how long have you been in operation, and where are you located?
So we started, I started the business in October of 15. We got our location in Silver Creek, actually in December of 15. And then through the permitting process, the manufacturing process, we actually went to market in America in March. I went to market overseas in November of last year. And then actually just Monday, I delivered my first full order, four pallets to the state for the state stores.
Okay. So what brought you into the business?
Well, it's a bit of a family story. I'm from Kentucky since the mid-1700s, and on the farm in Kentucky, you know, distilling is part of the, you know, sort of the natural process of using corn. You know, corn's very perishable, and obviously we all know the story of, you want to romanticize it with NASCAR and, you know, sort of overalls and yeehaw, but for us it wasn't that wild, or I don't know, maybe it was, and maybe my grandparents just didn't want to tell me those stories. But for us, it was utilizing the corn and the ethanol for, you know, not only for drinking purposes, but, you know, for veterinary applications, for antiseptic purposes. I mean, you know, spirit manufacturing is a diverse and a pretty important part of our culture. So obviously, I'm not in that aspect of it. But although people have had our spirits and it's made them happier, and so that makes me happy.
Well, so being from Kentucky, were you surprised about the licensing process in Utah? Was it more difficult to get licensed here? What did that look like?
Oh, Utah was fantastic. You know, it's interesting. When we were in, the Department of Agriculture invited us to participate at the Wine and Spirits Show in Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, we were, you know, obviously we're the only representative from Utah. There were six of us and, or maybe eight, sorry. But a lot of different questions about Utah, but truthfully, I couldn't ask for a better partner. Everyone that I've worked with has just been tremendous. I mean, 100% tremendous. Locally, you know, the fire department, you know, people in Colville, Summit County have just been wonderful. There's not a lot of legacy, you know, permitting, you know, so we kind of had to explain a lot. So sort of every meeting was sort of, okay, what do you do? What's the difference between brewing and distilling? Where are the danger points? Where are the – but fortunately you know, I couldn't ask for better partners. It's not a lot of drama on that one. And then the federal process is pretty well documented. It just takes a while. This is when it's good. I tell my boys, 8 and 11, I was like, you know, there's reward for being good, you know, and this is when it's nice to have never been arrested. Yeah, because they do a pretty extensive background check. So
right.
It was nice to, I will tell you, it's one of those processes where even though you know that you're clean, you know that you're going to pass, there's that anxiety, that, oh my gosh, you know, am I going to get the permit? So I remember very clearly getting the permit, and this, I didn't realize I was holding, you know, a yoga would say, you know, relax my shoulders and breathe a little bit. I didn't realize I was so tight. So it was nice to finally get that permit and then go in front of the board in Utah. And really, just again, it's just been, and the response from the city has just been tremendous. I mean, it's just been really nice to be so well received.
So you distribute locally, and where do you distribute to?
So Utah is what's called a control state. So Utah owns all the state liquor stores, and so there are no independent releases. That being said, we have what's called a Type 5 package agency license. So I sell direct to consumers at my Silver Creek location. I'm at the corner of Division and Silver Creek. So when we're there as a producer, we're able to sell our products directly to the customer at the same price that they would find in the state store. We also have now finally released our product to the state. And so we will be available in the state stores. Well, they have it now. So I would say just go and ask. Demand helps warrant shelf space. So if the listeners can just ask for Alpine products, then it helps us make sure that we're in some prominent location so that they can find us easy and purchase from the state stores.
So what sets your spirits apart from others?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I have a culinary background. You know the adage, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Well, I realized very quickly I need to get out of the kitchen. So I haven't cooked since I was 25, 26. But I love flavor, and I love cooking at home, and I love the complexity of flavor. I love, again, this juxtaposition of sort of sweet and spicy. I think there were some things that were missing. So the first products that we launched were two flavored products, our Lafayette Bourbon, which is a gold medal winning bourbon last year. It's a Kentucky bourbon that we flavor with apricot and cinnamon, and then primrose. Primrose is the local, touch. It's as an herbaceous plant, it has really no flavor, but it really adds a lot to the bouquet. And that's one of the compliments that we get a lot of times with the Lafayette, is that it smells great and it's extremely easy to drink. There are incredible cocktails being made with it locally. I'm a simpleton. I just pour a little bit of ginger beer and the Lafayette and, put a smile on my face, and that's good. And then the Preserve, which is our most decorated product. It's actually a fundraiser for the Swanner Nature Preserve. We live in Ranch Place on the Preserve. And it was inspired by the sunset that I see over the Uintas from our back deck. And so it's black tea, blood orange, and ginger. And one of the things that makes it unique is there's been a trend of higher viscosity, higher sweetness in liqueurs and in cordials. And for us, we really want to design sort of a classic aperitif that you could drink on your own, on its own. Add it with soda water, again, and then anything you would add a liqueur to, whether it's vodka, tequila, gin, sort of classic cocktails, or experiment. It really works well for that.
So, as you mentioned, kind of in a roundabout way, talked about is distilling is an art. It's this combination bringing things. Even some fragrance designers like Terry Mugler are using some of the same process to develop their
Absolutely.
Limited fragrance lines using bourbon barrels and
Absolutely.
Stuff like that. So what are you doing to be on the cutting edge of distilling? What are you looking forward to bringing into your business?
Well, it's a great question. The angle for us is really, the way we treat our water and hold the water. And then bringing in my large experience, I worked, I've only really had two jobs. One was with the National Football League and the other was Johnson & Johnson. So bringing those sort of major league experiences into consistency and into quality control with the products themselves. So with the water, we chose our location in Silver Creek as we pull water out of the aquifer. We engineered the water with local company Water Science and with my father, who is a dentist. So a chemistry background, really a strong understanding of the application of water into spirits. And we use citric acid to hold our water to slightly acidic state and at a cooler temperature than most. And I think that gives us a nice sort of a smoky sweet aspect. The body's ready to absorb our spirits. Which is nice. So some of the response that we've gotten, especially with the vodka where it's more pronounced. With the single malt, for which we just won gold, really is it's a combination of trying to respect my heritage as a Kentucky distiller, but also doing something that celebrates the grain. It's not an original idea. I was up in Glenfiddich and kind of got this idea from one of the products that they do in a very small batch, which is really, can we bring the flavor of the grain out more than the wood? And so, it's something that's just quite enjoyable and drinkable.
Well, it sounds amazing. And who knew water could impact the flavor of your spirits? Thank you so much for joining us. Real quick, where can people find out about you?
Yeah,
do you have a website?
Online, yep, alpinedistilling.com. Most of the social media stuff, Alpine Distilling. Mm-hmm. And then we're located right at the corner of Division and Silver Creek in the Silver Creek neighborhood.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Rob Sargent with Alpine Distilling. You're listening to KPCW's